Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson. There have been over 6,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln, so one might be inclined to think that there could be nothing left unsaid or unknown. Yet, you might be surprised at what you learn as we go between the lines of The Psychic Life of Abraham Lincoln by Susan B. Martinez. Susan is an independent scholar, journalist, and activist, and received her doctorate in anthropology from Columbia University. She's written about and researched psychic phenomena, specializing in modern spiritualism in the Victorian era. Currently, she's book review editor at the Academy of Spirituality and Paranormal Studies. Thank you so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today, Susan.
And thank you for having me.
Well, this has been a very intriguing book, The Psychic Life of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's religion was, and I guess still is, a widely debated topic among historians. And, you know, maybe perhaps it was because Lincoln's political career coincided with that great age of spiritualism that the country went through. Talk about that for just a minute, please, that 1850 era. You know, what was the country? What was the state of mind, if you will, of the country at that time?
You're talking about the period where Lincoln was just in the middle of his life. He was just in his prime. Normally, spiritual historians date the birth of modern spiritualism to the year 1848, and that started up in New York State, but it spread like wildfire, so that by 1850 it was already on the frontier in Illinois. People today hardly realize what a dynamic grassroots movement this was in that time. A new era had begun, a new way of thinking had begun, and it was as if the veil had been lifted and communications were starting to come through from the undead, as they say.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of alternative religion, if you will, wasn't there? A lot of utopian dreams. You know, you had the Shakers and you had the Monrovians and you had the this and the that.
Yes, the 1830s and the 1840s were periods of terrific reform in America. All of it, of course, was building up to the Great Civil War. We didn't know it. We feared it. But the 1830s, they had what historians would later label as the sisterhood of reforms. So you had abolition, you had spiritualism, you had women's rights, you had everything down
temperance.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for putting that, because that was the one that I had forgotten. This was the sisterhood of reforms. It was a very visionary period, and it was the time in which Lincoln was growing up.
Define spiritualism, if you will, because I'm not sure if we really...
Okay, I would like to define that very simply by saying that spiritualism is the belief in the immortality of the soul.
As simply as that?
As simple as that, because you've got a certain amount of misunderstanding that comes into this subject. I have come across numerous writers kind of on the outside of it rather than the inside of spiritualism who have given the following definition. They have said spiritualism is the belief that the dead can talk to the living. Now, in other words, through seances and communion of that sort. I say that's only a trivial definition, because that's not what spiritualism is. When a sitting is held for the departed to communicate to the living, it is only the true value of that thing is only that it's proving an afterlife, proving the immortality of the soul. So that's why I gave the definition the way I did, the immortality of the soul. And I'll add that it is the immortality of the soul and not the body. In other words, it's not reincarnation, but it's going on in spirit worlds unknown to us, but progressing and moving and learning in the direction of non-physical beings.
There were quite a few famous people that were identified as spiritualists, if you will. People like Louisa May Alcott, Emily Bronte, Emily Dickinson, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, Sherlock Holmes author. James Fenimore Cooper, Mark Twain, and even many senators and members of Congress, covertly. Another was Harriet Beecher Stowe. So what was this? How does that compare to what we've seen recently or a decade ago in terms of the New Age and or even Miss Cleo, if you will, the psychic hotline? Is there any similarity between the environments, or is it a totally different thing?
Oh, well, yes, there is a similarity. And I'm a spiritualist, so let me just make that clear. And I believe in the prophecy that came along at the time that modern spiritualism was born. And we have to take a broad perspective on this, because even though this thing came alive in the year 1848, it kind of slumped down during certain periods, then it rose up again. So what we're having now with the New Age and what we could call the occult explosion or the consciousness era, all of this is part of that same trend that began 150 years ago. And in fact, I don't think it will be yet completed for another 400 years. Oh. So we're dealing with a major cosmic thing, because we're coming into a cosmic time now. Mankind, the planet and mankind are no longer young. We are coming into maturity as a race and as a planet. And at this point, what prophecy says is that things get speeded up. We're going to reach old age in a rather rapid manner. But before the end of things on this planet, we will be spiritualized. So everything comes out according to its time. This is something I discussed also in a recent interview. In the old days, it was seances and sittings and materializations. And I could go into the details of why things were manifested in that way. In our day, one of the most prominent areas of spiritual or paranormal evidence comes in near-death experiences. We call them NDEs. We've got an acronym for everything now, and that's one of them, NDEs, near-death experiences, because we've reached the point in modern medicine where the dead are so frequently revived. And guess what? They all tell a similar story about what they are confronted with on the other side. So the expression of spiritualism comes forth in each age according to its developments and what's going on.
That's a good point.
I wish your listeners could see how vibrantly and enthusiastically you nod your head.
Well, you know, I was curious, especially in the beginning, it talked about how many of these spiritualists, if you will, came from the upstate New York area. What was that about? How did that area attract so many people?
Yes, and it was called the Burnt Over District, and I'll tell you why. Because so many religious passions were born and quickly burnt out there that they ended up calling it the Burnt Over District. But this is where Mormonism started, and this is where Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony, I mean, you name it, all of the visionaries of the time seem to sprout from that area, as well as the Fox sisters, who inaugurated the spiritual revolution in the year of 1848. It was a cradle of the new order for some reason.
Well, talk about the Fox sisters for a moment, because they were very prevalent in the book. And you said that they initiated this movement.
Yes, it was a spontaneous thing. They were young girls. They were just pre-adolescent girls. And there were some knockings and rappings in their home. And it was almost like it had been predestined for that family to become the first representatives of communicators with the other side, with the spirit world. There had been a peddler. The itinerant peddler was very common in those days, selling merchandise, who had his throat slashed in his sleep in that home. And this produced a a wandering spirit. This was the first communicator from the other side who came through, and there was a system of knocks and raps with yeses and nos where they began to be able to interpret what message was being sent. But
so how was it that this, that they were able to prove that this was authentic as opposed to a scheme or a trick? Because there were obviously tricksters out there and shams. What proof do we have that the fox sisters were authentic?
There is a recent book out on Hydesville, New York. That's where the Fox family home was. A recent book came out about a year ago, and there are other books on the Fox sisters. Anybody can read up on it to judge for themselves. There were tests. The Fox girls, as they became famous and started to travel and demonstrate their gift, were severely tested. There was a team of three professors from Harvard University who conducted a test, and there was lots of that going on. It's kind of like, for those who believe no test is necessary and for those who disbelieve, right, no test could prove it.
Right.
You have to become familiar with the literature and with the history of the times to judge for yourself. But there is a great deal to convince, I think, anybody that these girls had become the high priestesses of the new spiritualism.
You had mentioned earlier that this movement had spread so rapidly, and in the book it mentions that at one point, and I think you said 1855, there was literally no village that did not have its own medium or mediums, if you will. As a matter of fact, you mentioned in the book that in 1854, U.S. Senator James Scheele of Illinois presented a petition to Congress calling for Congress to investigate communications from the dead.
Yes, this is right.
Was it taken seriously?
They laughed it out of Congress, and the same guys who laughed it out were clandestinely going and seeing mediums. Yes, it's an interesting episode because James Shield, who presented that petition to Congress, happened to be an enemy of Lincoln's in Illinois politics, and we go into that in chapter one of the book.
So he was
he was the one who Lincoln had the duel with.
Oh.
He was challenged to a duel by Lincoln had been putting some not so nice criticisms of Shields in the paper, but let's let the readers just find that out for themselves.
Abraham Lincoln's initial foray into spiritualism. What do you think started his interest?
I think, both of his parents were somewhat clairvoyant. His mother, for example, predicted her own death. Even though it was a sudden thing, she died of the milk sick. Abraham was only nine. It was just something. The cows were eating a toxic root, and it came out in the milk, and it was just a terrible thing, young people dying. So yet she had predicted her own death. And the father also, we can see from actually the very opening passage of my book, shows the father's clairvoyant image of his future wife. It's something he saw in vision and in dream, and then he made it happen. So there was a background there for Lincoln in the first place. But I think that all the tragedy that piled up in his life, starting at age nine when his mother left, mm-hmm. went over in spirit, I think it started then because death and bereavement, death of a very close loved one, particularly in the pre-adolescent years, can produce a shifting around in the psyche and even an opening of the psychic eye.
Mm. Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and we're going between the lines with Susan Martinez, who has written an intriguing account of our 16th president's mystical practices, and I'm talking about Abraham Lincoln. Plus, Abraham Lincoln was a very creative person. He was a poet. I'm sure some people will be surprised to find out just how creative he really was, and it seems that maybe that has something to do with this ability also, maybe.
Creativity it does have a lot to do with it. Lincoln was a marvelous mime. He could mimic almost any dialect. He had a sense of humor that surpasses any president we ever had, and was just a side-splitting character in the jokes that he told and the portrayals he made. He was also a poet. He wrote some nice poetry that I came across, and he was a great admirer of the great poets. Nowadays, we call that right-brained. Mm-hmm. But if you put the whole picture together, it probably shows a person who is open to inspiration and influence. You take a look at the biographies of great artists and inventors, and many of them will forthrightly tell you that they have an inspiring genius who they listen to.
You mean a spirit?
It started with Socrates' daemon. He called it his daemon, and it moved on to many of the great writers and artists, particularly of the 19th century, who were aware of an inspiration outside of themselves.
Like a muse?
Like the muse. There you go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So who was Lincoln's muse? Did he have one?
One thing that came out in my research, and it's mentioned briefly in the book, is Daniel Webster, who happened to be the leading Whig in Congress in the years that Lincoln himself was in Congress. That was in 1847 and 1848, if I have it more or less off by a year. Lincoln was a mere congressman from Illinois, but Daniel Webster was the prime speaker and head chief Whig of that time. That was Lincoln's party, the Whigs. He was a very inspiring character. He had a great booming voice, and he was a genius of oratory. Something that comes out in my book is that the spirits who were pushing Lincoln on toward the Emancipation Proclamation seemed to be headed by a person with the same booming voice and oratorical trills as Daniel Webster. And several people did notice this, including Lincoln. You see, the medium loses her own voice when she's channeling the other spirit, and the voice that came through seemed to be that of Daniel Webster.
That I found that fascinating. I really had not really heard that whole history about the spiritualism connected with the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, I will tell you that one of the sources that meant the most to me in writing this book was a passage that I found in the OASPE Bible. And that's a book that covers 80,000 years of man's history, but it ends with America, because America is a destined land. And it brings a very dramatic picture forward of the angels, a congress of spirits, having selected Lincoln in the first place as the president of this land for the purpose of bringing on the Emancipation Proclamation, because to end bondage in this country also meant to end it in the world. So there is a very strong impression from the research I did that a Congress of Spirits was behind not only Lincoln's rise to power, but the whole entire Civil War. That so many wars seem pointless, but the Civil War was different. There was something, there was some moral point to it, and Lincoln himself recognized this process, I would say, halfway through the war, and he called it providence, that God requires this war. It was something that he came to see. It was something that all the pacifists and spiritualists would have liked to see end, but even they realized that there was some reason why this great bloodletting was taking place in America.
And even Abraham Lincoln, though, had a feeling early on as a young boy that he was destined to be president.
Yes,
he did. Is that not true?
Yes, he did. And he had a prophetic side to his nature. He felt this from probably even in childhood. And then when he paddled down the Mississippi and ended up in New Orleans at the age of 22, he was carrying cargo down there. That was his business at that time. He consulted a black oracle, a fortune-telling woman there, and She looked at him and said, "You will be a president of the United States." The trip to New Orleans was also the first time Lincoln saw the slave auction firsthand. Mm. So it's kind of an interesting moment in his life.
Mm.
He said, "If I ever get a chance to lick that thing, I'll beat it."
Mm. I've heard a debate about whether Lincoln really did free the slaves out of the goodness of his heart, or was it really a political decision that it was just done to satisfy, you know, some of the...
Well, at the time, the politically correct thing to say was that it was a war measure. And in point of fact, the only slaves that were freed in the January 1st, 1863 declaration were in rebel states. So the slaves in the states that were part of the Union were not freed. It was only a partial thing. Of course, by January 1865, they already got in Congress the 13th Amendment, which abolished all slavery. But this was a stepwise process. This was not going to be done in one blow.
Mm. Yeah, good point, good point. Was there any political fallout to Lincoln's involvement with spiritualism, or maybe more so Mary's involvement with respect to their participation in seances and so forth?
In both cases, yes. This was the first thing that Lincoln's enemies would seize upon, because in those days it was common knowledge that Lincoln was involved with psychic mediums, calling seances. There were many sittings in the White House. They took place in the Red Parlor. I have a list of the names of ten mediums that Lincoln consulted during his time of office, and I'm sure that's just scratching the surface. Mm. Yes, it was common knowledge, and his enemies would pounce on it to make the accusation that he was basing policy, governmental policy, on what some airy-fairy spirit was telling him. And you can see that nothing could be further from the truth. Lincoln was a man who made his own decisions. He developed the Emancipation Proclamation quite independently and secretly. He kept it in his vest until the very last minute, September 22nd, 1862, when he showed it to his cabinet. He was a man who would digest everything that came at him and arrive at his own truth.
Mm. A self-taught man, too, in many cases. Did he believe that he was able to enter altered states of consciousness?
I would say that I found that one of the most interesting areas of his psychic life, that he was a natural to fall into what we would nowadays call the alpha state. The alpha is the brainwave just beyond the ordinary beta wave of ordinary daily living and consciousness. Alpha is somewhere between awake and asleep. Alpha is creative moments. Alpha is daydreaming and so forth. The alpha state was quite common to him. There were people who thought that he was dozing off, but he was really contemplating. There are so many funny stories connected with this. When you do go into histories recorded by his contemporaries, everybody noticed his mood changes, where he drifted off and then just came back. Something that we were able to document, a vision in the White House while he was drifting off, and he ran to the telegraph office to find out if it was true. It had to do with the positioning of the Confederate troops. Sure enough, it was true before a telegram ever came through. The telegraph operator said to him, "How do you know that?" Lincoln goes, "I saw it, man."
Wow.
He was just half asleep in his chair.
He put a lot of emphasis on his dreams, or rather he thought a lot about his dreams and the significance of them. The one thing I didn't really understand is why, because if he was so in touch, why did he ignore his own premonitions about his death?
This question has been asked before, and I suppose it's something people would be curious about, but I will tell you that President Kennedy, JFK, did the same thing, and those two have been compared. There are so many fascinating similarities between them, but Kennedy was aware of what has been called the presidential death curse, because every 20 years, a president who had been elected in a zero year died in office. This is since 1840, and President William Henry Harrison in 1840 died in office, hardly spent 30 days in the White House. And then ever since, 20 years later, Lincoln, 20 years later, Garfield, 20 years later, McKinley, etc.
It all started with an Indian curse,
yes,
too.
It did.
That was interesting.
Yeah,
you want to share
yeah.
that?
I do, but I want to get – I just want to finish up
okay,
on
sure,
Kennedy because Kennedy was aware of the curse, as were Reagan and Bush, who had intercessory prayer for them, just all based on this Indian curse. But Kennedy was aware of it, and he discussed it with his White House doctor, Janet Travell, I think was her name. And he made a flippant comment. He said, if anybody were to take this curse seriously – pretty soon there'd be a 4-inch sign out in front of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So his spirit was very much like Lincoln's, where there was a certain sense of destiny and of fatalism there that he could not prevent his own death. And Lincoln felt the same all the more. They didn't have bubbles and high security in Lincoln's days. He wasn't really ready to forego his freedom and his freedom from fear, for that matter. He felt he was destined to be cut down from the high place that he had achieved.
And Lincoln and Kennedy both did not have bodyguards, because Kennedy refused bodyguards, didn't he?
Yes, and you know, this is the same with McKinley, who got shot down in 1901. Why would anyone want to shoot me? And I can understand their viewpoint. I would hate to be surrounded by so much security that my freedom was gone.
Right. I would, too. Lincoln very much felt that. As a matter of fact, he was the only American president that never joined a church. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. He was a free thinker. They praised him for this afterwards. Nowadays, people always want to put Lincoln on their church. Oh, he rented, one interviewer pointed out to me, oh, he rented a pew in the Presbyterian church. Well, Mary was Presbyterian, and he did it for appearance sake, but the man himself washed his hands of any dogma and simply wanted to find out what was out there in the universe and how he relates to it.
Well, I don't know if Abraham Lincoln was a spiritualist, but he certainly seemed to be a spiritual
There you
person.
Go. It doesn't matter.
That's right. And I love his motto, which is one my husband and I share, which is the bottom line is do the right thing. And that's ultimately, I think, what Lincoln was trying to get to, is at that stage where his decisions were based on doing the right thing. Susan, this has been so enlightening. Thank you so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
And I thank you.
Susan Martinez's book is The Psychic Life of Abraham Lincoln. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. Executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Mary. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.